Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. 20th of April, 2019. Well, it was another one of those gang fire, conflagration, wildfires everywhere week, was it not? And, you know, we're not going to go down the rabbit hole except for just a couple little things on the Mueller report that you need to know that, you know, nobody else is reporting, as usual. And I'm going to give you my take just in general, without getting into specifics, which are getting just beat to death by a national media that loves to chase, you know, glittering objects, primarily to get your mind off of other much more important objects. So we're going to talk a little bit about that this morning. And we're going to talk a little bit about, since it was tax day, just, the 15th, whatever day that was a Tuesday? I've lost track of time. I got some really interesting statistics for you on Americans, their taxes. And you can put that in the context of the Democratic candidates, almost all of them, talking about 70 to 90% tax rates. Yeah, you bet. That'll make you smile or retch, one or the other. We're going to talk just a little bit about immigration. Interesting story out of New York. You know, our friend, comrade Bill de Blasio, God, he's just disgusting, as is Cuomo. But a really interesting little tweak there, since Trump has said he's going to be sending illegal aliens to sanctuary cities, which I think is terrific. Get them on the buses and get them going. And we're going to be talking about some things which are coming up. You know, I told you 2 years ago, maybe it was two and a half, and I was the only one in the media at that time, and then several others joined in. Mark Levin, who's terrific, and Sean Hannity is terrific. They began talking about a year ago how this was going to boomerang. I believe that's Hannity's words. But it was I who told you two or two and a half years ago, when really all this came down kind of right before the election. Or we came to know of it. It came down before then. I told you that the Democrats were going to rue the day they began that treasonous hoax. And that day has arrived. We're going to talk a little bit about that. I'm going to tell you just some really interesting little facts that nobody else is telling you about what's happening with the behind-the-scenes investigations and where they're going. I might add that if you watched Bill Barr's press conference when he released the Mueller report on Thursday, 48 give or take hours ago, and the press was doing their usual, oh man, kangaroo court. I mean, it's just outrageous. I mean, just outrageous. Donald Trump is exactly right. The majority, unfortunately, the majority of the press in the United States is the enemy of both the country and the people. It's as a trained journalist, I will tell you, it is heartrending, pathetic. So we're going to talk about that, and boy, there's some, this is going to reach to Obama. It's absolutely already reached Hillary. It's probably going to reach to John Kerry. It's absolutely going to reach to Brennan, who is just a disgusting human being, as well as a traitorous CIA director. It's absolutely going to reach to Clapper and a whole bunch more people, and Comey. I mean, it's going to reach, and Lynch. It's going to reach those top eight or nine people in the Obama administration. I'm going to give you some little tidbits you have absolutely not heard before, which are coming out in all sorts of different discovery, including the great job the Judicial Watch is doing. And I tout them all the time. Send them money. Send them money. Those guys are doing yeoman's work. I have an interesting little thing to tell you about the senatorial elections in 2020. That, gee, once again, I don't think anybody's telling you about. Kind of hopeful for the Republicans, notwithstanding Mitt Romney. We'll talk about him in the very short segment I'm doing on the Mueller report. And then we have part two of the five-part series of civilizational jihad. And this is going to be quite a series when I'm all done. We're going to be talking about Barack Obama and who he is and the influence that Soros, yes, there's that guy again, probably the number one enemy of America in the world, George Soros, Obama close second. And the weird influence that Valerie Jarrett, born in Iran, Tehran, Iran, and George Soros had over Barry Obama. And then we're going to be talking in one of the parts about how Obama systematically put, and I did a show on this quite some time ago. You should just type in Muslim Brotherhood, Obama Muslims, however. Just about any combination of those will bring that show up. I name names. This is going to go, this segment's going to go, not this segment, but that part in the next show or two is going to go into much greater detail. And how Obama intentionally dismantled safety systems and intentionally and secretly installed other systems to allow Muslim Brotherhood cronies of his, and you'll understand the Muslim Brotherhood much, much better at the end of this show, of his in all sorts of high places in the government, including government security offices, FBI, CIA, you name it. And we're going to be talking about also the assault on freedoms under Obama and how that was not just influenced by his alt-left ideology, but also by his Islamist Muslim Brotherhood affiliations and alliance. It's really the nexus of the Unholy Alliance, another show I did a year and a half ago prior to anybody else talking about it, and that is this nexus, this sordid and evil association of the alt-left and Islamists. Remember the definition. Muslims are Muslims. You know, they have a faith, just like Jews, just like Christians, just like whatever. Their nationality comes first. Their faith, although very important, comes second. But Islamists are different. Islamists are Muslims who believe in world domination of Islam. And they'll do it violently when they have to, although they prefer the stealth approach, the civilizational jihad approach, which is what this five-part series that I'm bringing to you, this is part two this week, is about. And this week we're going to be talking about, when we get there, last segment, how the United States government really was captured, and I'm not overplaying that word, by the Muslim Brotherhood, not only under Obama's watch, but with his tacit assistance, premeditated assistance. Quite scary. Okay, and of course we're going to have our story. Oh, we got to have our story. And you know, the story this morning ties right into all these other segments, as you'll see. But first, I want to wish everybody an absolutely terrific Passover. All my Jewish listeners out there, who I hope are part of the Jexit movement, i.e. getting the hell out of the Democratic Party, and all my Christian listeners, and yes, I have Muslim listeners too. You know, there are many, 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 many moderate Muslims out there who are Americans first, Muslims second. Unfortunately, there is a powerful, large minority, it's not small, large minority, who are Islamists. But we'll be talking about that later in the deal. I hope all you folks have just the greatest holiday of whatever types of holidays you celebrate over this weekend. You know, I also want to talk about, I'm going to talk about some other things, some bullet points real quick, and draw some, give you some dots and draw some connecting lines that nobody else is doing. For instance, I'll just give you a teaser. You might have noticed last week, although it was lost in the hubbub of everything that was going on, Bernie Sanders jumping up and down, saying that not only should felons have the right to vote, but felons in prison, including felons in prison for murder, should have the right to vote. They should be able to vote from their prison cells. At the same time and on the same day, Cory Booker was talking about reparations. For brown and black, not just black, brown and black-skinned people. You know, there's a study that came out last week. Once again, hardly covered. The left has been telling us immigrants create less crimes than native-born Americans. I mean, I've dispelled that myth on other shows. This study just kind of highlights it. While legal immigrants to this country, legal immigrants, folks who waited in line, jumped through the hoops, took their oath, studied their civics, studied the Constitution, got their citizenship, do in fact have the lowest crime rate of any segment of the American population. Illegal aliens have the highest. 38%, folks, of the people being held in detainer, and I don't mean, the 20-day temporary asylum nonsense. I'm talking about people being held awaiting trial for serious felonies are illegal aliens. 22% of our prison population, at a huge cost to the American taxpayer, 22% of our prison population. This is serious felonies, violent felonies, rape, murder, assault, you name it, are illegal aliens. 22% of the total prison population in the United States. However, even given the numbers that people are starting to bandy around now of 22 million illegal aliens in the United States, illegal alien population is only about 6.5%, which is still a huge, high, scary number. Think about how many presidential elections are decided by 1 or 2%, never mind 6.5%. And, of course, the Democrats know that. Also, gee, that's no coincidence. We don't need a wall. There's nothing to see here. There's no crisis. No problem. Oh, you know, if you're Christian, you have to take them in. And we caused it all, and it was climate change. We screwed up the climate, so they had to leave Honduras, and on and on and on. So 6.5% of the United States population, not citizens, population, comprises 22% of all inmates, that is, convicted serious felons in our prison system. And 40% of those, 38% of those awaiting trial for similar types of crimes. You know, those facts are kind of hard to overcome. So the next time you hear or one of your to the left friends tries to tell you about how immigrants have lower, you can cite these facts. Kind of interesting, kind of unsettling, actually. I also, before we get started, we're going to go to the story now. It's story time. And so it's a fitting time to tell you that all of you Threads West readers, Threads West and American Saga series readers, my number one national best-selling, winner of 26 national awards, historical fiction series, begins out here in the Rockies, May of 1854. Books 4, 5, and 6, and 4 has been 4 is quite late. I have a million people who want to pitchfork me and lynch me. Plus the libs who listen to this show, so maybe several million. But they'll have to stand in line behind my readers. My readers come first. But books 4, 5, and 6, as I told you last week, the publishers are firming up the release dates. And this is tentative. Let me underline this, tentative. Those of you who are will be getting news from the publisher's website. Those of you who are not on the publisher's website, you need to be. www.threadswestseries.com. Threadswestseries.com. Take you 10 seconds to register. There isn't 5 or 6 emails a year that come out of there, and they all have news. You can also go to the Threads West Facebook page, facebook.com/ThreadsWest. Throw a like at it, and that's also another reliable source of information. Let me emphasize, the only accurate sources of information for the release of these books are those two outlets. Not Barnes & Noble, not Amazon, not Books A Million, not anybody else, period. The tentative dates, and this will be confirmed in a little email newsletter from the websites to those of you who are subscribed, look like August 8th for book four. October 10th for book five, Footsteps. Book four is Moccasin Tracks, Moccasin Track. And December 5th, we hope, for Blood of Gloria to Pass, the Civil War book. And there are a huge amount of pre-sales, which is really cool. Thank you, all you great readers, and thanks for your patience. And the publishers, unlike just about any other outfit anywhere, allow you to reserve books. It actually gives them a pretty good count for printing and all that kind of stuff. To reserve books on the ThreadsWestSeries.com website for free. Does not cost you a dime. And you are far more likely, if the print run is less than demand at the time of release, and it looks like it's going to be, again, thank you, readers, you are far more likely to get a book if you are on the publisher's mailing list than if you are simply somewhere else. So stay tuned for all this. It's kind of exciting. I really can't wait to get those books out into everybody's hands. Let's go to our story. Enough about me. So, catapult yourself backwards in time. Zip! You know, AOC this week said that she was a time traveler from the future, and she was just forewarning us that the world was going to end in 12 years. Wow. The bug-eyed babe from the Bronx is getting even more buggy-eyed. But I digress. Catapult yourself back. Strap yourself into your time machine. Zip! And you are now in 1241 AD. That's a long, long, long time ago. Like, you know, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. But, you know, apropos to what's going on today, as I'll explain. So, on April 8th, 1241 AD, two huge armies met to decide the fate of Western civilization. Gee, that's kind of like today, isn't it? Two powerful forces locked in combat, one ruthless and one kind of pathetic, over the fate of Western civilization today, too. This was in the middle of Europe. The middle of Europe. And the guys from the east were called the Mongols. Now, all the cheerleaders for the other guys, the European guys, called them the Mongol Horde. Ooh, nasty, nasty, nasty. And they were not the favorite of the crowds, so to speak, the betting crowds, whatever they were back at that time. 25 years before this fateful day, this day of the great battle for Western civilization, on April 8th, 1241 AD, the Mongol Horde, their leader, whose name was Genghis Khan, he developed the first format for cavalry use in combat and just outright ferocity. And he had conquered virtually all of China. And they headed west. They overran Samarkand at that time, 14 other quote-unquote principalities or nations, and they took over all of southern Russia, half of Russia. And then Genghis, baby, heard that there was all this really good stuff, like food and women and riches, you know, all the stuff that a Mongol horde would want. And it was in a place called Europa, which is Europe. Well, anyway, Genghis decided that, you know, Europe should be under Mongol control. Genghis died, however, before the great advance by the Mongol horde on Europe began. And the guy who took over the Mongol horde team, the new coach, was his son, Ogatai. O-G-O-T-A-I, Ogatai. And Ogatai, of course, you know, had grown up rather privileged, being the son of Genghis Khan. And he figured that he was like a really good delegator and a really good kind of manager of the Mongol horde. So he hired a grandson of Genghis Khan. Kind of sounds like Days of Our Lives, is like modern soap opera. He hires a grandson of his father, and the kid's name, he was 32 years old, which is really quite old at that time, was Batu Khan, B-A-T-U Khan, K-H-A-N. And he was, as an analogy, kind of the general Petrius of that time. Brilliant tactician, brilliant general, and he took the art of the Mongol hordes and their cavalry to a whole nother level, even beyond the kind of brilliant leadership of Genghis Khan. So Batu Khan sets out to take Europe, which is 1,000 miles away. In no time at all, he overcomes and conquers everybody in his way for 1,000 miles. Now, you know, 1,000 miles is kind of a big distance today. You can imagine what it was like 3,500 years ago. I mean, it was it was like going to the moon. He conquers everything in his path. He was like a locust horde. And on April 8th, 1241 AD, he finally meets the great armies of Europe. And he was on a hill. And facing him was the cream of European knighthood. There was Polish and German armies, the Saxons and the Anglos had sent their best knights. I mean, it was an amazing array of European military might in their armor, with their flags flying, all lined up ready to repulse the Mongol horde. Thousands upon thousands of foot soldiers with their spears and their broadswords and their chain link cloth, their mail cloth, you know, across their shoulders to protect them from blows from the advancing Mongols. The town, by the way, where all this took place was called Liegnitz. At that time, it was in Prussia. Now it's currently in modern Germany. And all the townsfolk, of course, knowing that their vaunted European army, their chivalrous knights, clad in their armor with their flags flying and their horses prancing, were going to be, you know, they were going to rout the Mongol horde and cast them back 1,000 miles to whence they came. So all the townsfolk are out behind the European army, and they're all kind of gawking, you know, spectating and all the stuff that they do. And Batu Khan took one look from this hill at this huge, huge army out in front of him. Spread out, they say, 3 or 4 miles wide and a mile deep. I mean, it was a bunch of soldiers. And he kind of laughed. Did you ever see that scene in Indiana Jones? There's this guy with a scimitar, you know, wearing an Arab garb and robe. And he's obviously an expert with this huge scimitar with this huge curved blade. And he does all this kind of weird scimitar movements. And he's facing off against Indiana Jones, who's about 30 feet away. And he stops and he raises his sword as if he's about to charge. And Indiana takes out his pistol and shoots him. End of story. Well, Batu Khan took one look at this mighty army opposing his folks and came up with a brilliant strategy. So he ordered his, and he had thousands and thousands of troops too. He ordered his cavalry, which was most of the army, they had very few foot soldiers, to charge at the European lines. But before they reached them, out of arrow flight, out of, you know, reach of the arrows, to split and to go all the way around their flanks and to keep heading, you know, I guess it would be east, actually west. So his devise was, hey, you know, I don't have to go through this wall. I'll go around the wall. But he had another trick up his sleeve. He hit about a third of his monstrous Mongol horde cavalry behind this hill that he was watching all this from. And as two-thirds of his army, which was huge, charged the Europeans braced themselves for the assault. And, you know, the knights are running up and down the lines telling the men, you know, you can picture the battle. And all of a sudden, the Mongol horde split around the European army, and they go streaming by on either flank. And, of course, the European army, thinking that there was something going on, they turned around to repulse what they were sure was going to be an attack from the rear from these Mongols that had gone around their flanks. And of course, at that time, the Khan raised his hand, and the other third of his army charged the front of the Europeans, which, unfortunately for the Europeans, were their backs now. The other two wings of Khan's army then circled around. They were now, well, they were now where the Europeans were facing, which had been behind the European lines. And the Europeans, all the knights and all the flags and all the soldiers and all their armor, were now surrounded by Mongol hordes who literally cut them to ribbons, like 75% casualties, and then kept heading west to conquer the rest. Now, you might be asking why this story, which I love as a kind of a military tactician or a follower of military tactics, I love that story because it's brilliant, brilliant generalship. But it's so apropos today because the chivalrous knights, the hollow suits, so to speak, that are facing the hordes are the Democrats. And the hordes, the deplorables and the ten-tooth people and the smelly Walmart shoppers, you know, the Americans who still hold American values dear, we are the Mongols, according to the press, of course. This is all according to the press. So we are facing the chivalrous knights, and we are the Mongol horde. And our leader is Donald Khan. And what happened there in Germany, or now today's Germany, 3,500 whatever years ago, is about to happen again to the chivalrous knights. Because while they are busy stewing in the Mueller report, very unwisely continuing their nonsense, stupidly talking about impeachment, not doing their job whatsoever, allowing all sorts of critical things, healthcare, immigration, federal deficit, budget. I mean, the list is endless. The list is endless. Russia, China, and I don't mean Russia, Trump. I'm talking about Russia versus the United States. China, Iran, North Korea. All these things are like in this, they're lost in the dust, if you will, of their steady march along a suicidal, politically suicidal path of this Mueller thing. And I think what's going to happen is about the same thing that happened to all those knights so long ago, except it will not be violent. It will not be blood and spears and lances and swords. It will be the Department of Justice under Mr. Barr. And who knows how many grand juries, and who knows how many prosecutors or prosecutorial teams. And the side general will be Horowitz from the DOJ. I don't know if you saw the presser that Bill Barr gave when he released the Mueller report on Thursday. The press treated him, and the press has been treating him for the last week since he came out with his memo, like a pariah, like a piece of scum. I mean, this is an honorable American. This guy is a straight arrow. And I always watch in these situations, I watch people's faces. Yes, the words tell you something, but you know what? It's the faces. It's their facial expressions that tell you the most. And I watched his face get harder and harder and harder, and his lips become more and more compressed, and his eyes narrow as that presser went on. And when he walked out, he didn't look left or right, and he looked like he had a purpose. And I would bet you that he got back to his office and said, you know those investigations that we got going? Here's another 30 that I want started. I think Democrats are in for... they're in for a Genghis Khan moment. in the not-too-distant future. The Mueller report itself, folks, I have said this since day one. Let me repeat it again. Mueller is a dirty cop. Yes, he may have been a war hero and a Marine and all that stuff, and God bless him for that. Thank you. But since he became part of the deep state, since he worked for Obama, he has been corrupted. His corruption shone brightly in the Uranium One deal with Obama, Obama, Holder, and Hillary Clinton. And he was a linchpin of that deal, which, trust me, he really doesn't want to investigate it. His report, to sum it up, is 400 pages. The first 200 pages is kind of black and white. There is no collusion. Make it real simple. In fact, not only is there no collusion, but the Russians tried to collude with the Trump campaign. They wouldn't do it. The last 200 pages of the report, however, are about obstruction of justice. Not black and white at all. Written like a fairy tale. I've read it. And I will tell you that there are all sorts of inaccuracies, inconsistencies, and downright untruths either by actual statement or misrepresentation in that report. And it was done in a most devious fashion. Let me give you some examples. On page 61, there's one of the guys from the Trump team. I forget the gentleman's name. He's on TV from time to time, various stations. And they wanted to know, he was approached by a guy by the name of Harvey Greenberg, who offered to dig up dirt or give him dirt on Hillary from the Russians. And this guy said, no, I don't want to meet with you, and I don't want the dirt. Thanks very much. That was one of the many instances in which various members of the Trump team were approached with quote-unquote Russian dirt on Hillary, and they all said, no, thank you. Anyway, when he was being questioned by Mueller's team, he realized that this guy Greenberg, he could just see a flicker of recognition or whatever in the eyes of the interrogators, and he hired a private investigator, and he has DemocratDossier.com, that's the website. He has all the stuff, all the backup, Greenberg's FBI informant visas, 14 of them, and all sorts of other stuff. But my point is that in the Mueller report, where they devote this page to this guy and Harvey Greenberg, guess what they leave out? They leave out that Harvey Greenberg was being paid by the FBI. And he had been paid by the FBI as an informant for 17 years prior to him trying to gin up this contact with this gentleman whose name I don't recall right now. Now, that's kind of a material omission, which leads you to think that it's probably not the only one, and it's not. Another thing which has kind of arisen, which is most interesting, shall we say, rather fascinating, and that is exactly how did Mueller arrive at he couldn't indict nor could he exonerate Trump on obstruction of justice. Now, let me tell you that under law, a prosecutor doesn't exonerate. He indicts or he doesn't, period. And while the Democrats are jumping up and down, oh, he didn't exonerate him. You know, they're looking at the cup the wrong way. The way this should be looked at, folks, is no, he didn't indict him. He didn't find criminal or whatever wrongdoing in obstruction of justice. And it's not his job, nor does he have the power, to exonerate anybody. The fact that Robert Mueller, with however many FBI agents he had at his disposal, including rabid anti-Trump FBI agents like Stroke and Lisa Page, 40, I believe, 40 FBI agents, and 19 staff attorneys. I believe 12 of them were Hillary Clinton donors. One of them, Andrew Weissman, who himself is a dirty, dirty cop, went to her quote-unquote victory party. Another, who was actually the attorney for the Clinton Foundation. obviously a biased group of investigators. 2,500 or 2,800 subpoenas, 500 search warrants. I mean, this is unbelievable. And even that prejudiced team, with all that time and all that energy and all of our money, that's you and me, folks, you know, the Mongol horde, the Mongol freedom-loving American patriot horde, they couldn't find anything. Therefore, they couldn't say there was anything criminal and they couldn't indict. The only reason they put the words in there they can't exonerate is to keep something alive so that their cohorts, their co-conspirators in Congress, like Schiff and Swalwell and, you know, Nadler and Maxine Waters and whatever other loonies, would have something to kind of keep the home fires burning, if you know what I mean. That we can't exonerate statement is proof all by itself, never mind everything else, that Robert Mueller is a dirty cop. Dirty, dirty, dirty. Every page of that 400 pages was marked down at the bottom, confidential and classified. So the Mueller team, as a dastardly joke, they probably had it lined up with the Democrats. The Democrats are jumping up and down trying to convince the American public that, you know, Barr is dirty and Trump is hiding stuff and, you know, we're not getting full transparency. I'm not going to go into all that, all those details. But every page was marked classified and confidential. It was a booby trap for Barr. If he released anything illegally, guess what? His butt's on the line. The Democrats know this. That's why it took Barr 2 weeks to go through the documents with members of Mueller's team. I'd love to know more about that. Redacting, getting their approval to release page by page with redactions. Now, Robert Mueller knew full well that people wanted to see this report, that the Democrats were going to clamor for the report. Yet he put this landmine on every page. Dirty cop. And we come to learn, oh, not that it's a surprise, the Mueller team concluded that Trump, in no way, shape, or form, nor any member of his campaign, nor any American, I'll talk about in a moment, colluded with any other foreign power, including Russia. Except that he reached that conclusion 6 to 9 months before the 2018 midterm elections and sat on it. Now, why do you think he'd do that? Oh, that's right, the Democrats took the House. Huh, imagine that. What a coincidence. Then we have, I can go on and on. Here's the bottom line, because I don't want to spend a lot of time on the Mueller report. You can turn on every station and, you know, I'm sick of hearing Mueller, I'm sick of hearing Russia, I'm sick of the Democratic communists whining and crying and making up crap, and I'm sick and tired of the lying media, and I'm sure you are too. I mean, I am sick and tired of it. Remember that movie where the guy, what was it, he threw his TV out the window? I'm sick and tired. I'm not going to take it anymore. The Mueller report, folks, is exactly what I told you would be 2 or 3 weeks ago. It is way overwritten, far too long, includes all sorts of nonsense that should not be included. It was written by partisan hacks who tried to leave, some kind of nuggets out there for their Democratic co-conspirators and the press. Because there was nothing else they could do. After 2.5 years, 40 FBI agents, 19 Hillary attorneys, 2,800 subpoenas, 500 interviews, however many search warrants, etc. There was nothing. So they had to create something. It's exactly what I told you they would do. And I told you the Democrats stupidly would continue to try to keep that torch alive and charge up the hill with it. And I told you that the press would go bonkers and support the Dems in every one of their, at this point, treasonous acts. And that's exactly what's going on. But I'm going to repeat what I said before. Oh, and they're joined by one or two Republicans like Mitt Romney, gag me, who yesterday gives out this statement saying, I'm so troubled by what I read in the report, and it was a reprehensible behavior on the part of the highest officials in government and the president himself. I mean, Mitt, are you just a friggin' moron? You know, I mean, are you like John McCain's blood brother? Why don't you just put a Democrat in front of your name and go over and caucus with them? I mean, the guy is unbelievable. And, of course, his crony and his disciple, Paul Ryan, single-handedly sabotaged the wall while the Republicans controlled Congress, and single-handedly sabotaged and sat on his butt for 7 years pretending he wanted to repeal Obamacare and didn't have a health care replacement plan, and on and on and on. I mean, the Rhino Republicans, the Never Trump Republicans, absolutely make me want to puke. And Romney's right up there amongst the, you know, the most nausea-inducing guys. How's that? You know, there's this kind of rabid alt-left commentator. I think she's on CNN and MSNBC and, you know, all the lefty fake news places. Her name is Ruhle, R-U-H-L-E, and she was on one of those absolutely out-to-lunch shows, and here's a quote. Why can't the Republicans nominate someone who isn't a despicable human being, but can do a lot of good things? You bet she's a Democratic communist. Well, let me bring this little tidbit to Ms. Rule's attention. MSNBC, which is where this quote was taken, painted John McCain, who at that time everybody thought was a pretty good, decent guy, in 2008, and Mitt Romney, who at that time everybody thought was a pretty good, decent guy, they painted both those candidates when they were running against Barry Obama, Mr. Islamist traitor himself, as despicable human beings. Huh? Binders full of women, you know? That was Mitt Romney's downfall. And putting his family dog on the roof when he traveled. And Harry Reid's McCarthyist lies about Mitt Romney never paid taxes, and then Harry Reid admitting afterwards, I was lying, he paid his taxes, but we won the election. So, the hypocrisy, the two-faced position of mainstream media and the Democrats is just, it's not surprising anymore, but it continues to be breathtaking. Now, let me give you a little prognostication. I'm going to speed this up because I'm trying to keep these shows short for summer schedule and the stations are counting on it. My prognostication is this. There is a 50-50 chance the House will move ahead with impeachment in one way that would distract us even more from pressing problems everywhere. But on the other hand, they are so obstructionist that, you know, the pressing problems everywhere, some of them are going to get handled because Trump's a bull, and some of them just aren't going to get handled in his first term. So since nothing's going to happen anyway on any momentous matter, I hope they move ahead with impeachment. Because if they do, Trump's going to win re-election by a landslide. Because people are tired of this stuff. I mean, tired of it. And I mean, a lot of the Democrats are tired of it. And people want to see bread and butter things that mean something to them and their family and their everyday life and their security handled. And this is not doing any of it. In fact, it's aiding and abetting Russia. It's aiding and abetting Russia in its original plan, which was to kind of create a ruckus on both campaigns and in the middle of both campaigns and to leave the system in shambles. They've done a hell of a job. Of course, they couldn't have done it without collusion from the mainstream media and the Democrats. So I find this interesting. Let's go to the next segment. Taxes. So on April 15th, all of you, or by April 15th, just a few days ago, all of you had to either file your taxes or file an extension with your estimated payment, or the chances were that sometime in the future, you'd be listening to this radio show behind bars. So I'm sure that all of you took care of that. Well, here's some interesting stats. You know, immediately after the sting of writing that check, or you're coming euphoria over getting your big, much bigger than last year, refund, which the Democrats told you you'd never get, and which will be in the mail to you shortly. Total tax revenues each year hauled in by our buddies in D.C. are $3.5 trillion. You know, I mean, the poker winnings and the bingo jackpots and the lemonade stand sales and cash gratuities, A through Z. You know, it's all taxed. It's all taxed. There was a Supreme Court justice by the name of O.W. Holmes. And he babbled something in 1904, and that was, taxes are the price that you pay for civilization. Remember that phrase here as we go through this segment. The United States tax code, folks, now bulges with 7 million words. That's a number of times larger than King James Bible as a reference point. Perfect for Easter. And the average American, it varies a little bit, American to American, family to family, taxpayer to taxpayer, but the average American, tax freedom day, the day at which you stop working to pay your taxes, i.e. for the government, as the good little serf you are, and the day that you actually start putting the money in your pocket falls this year on April 16th, 2 days ago. So congratulations to all of us. We have busted our butts, busted our humps, sweated blood and tears, worked ourselves to the bone, and as of 3 days ago, woohoo, we're actually putting some money in our pocket for the first time since January 1. Ah, feels so good. I think I'm going to go out and buy something. All right, well, to put that in perspective for you, do you know what serfs in medieval times? Oh, yeah, that's right, Genghis Khan, all, you know, those times. Medieval serfs, folks, paid taxes of 10%. Not 15, not 20, not 25, not 30, not 35, not 39, but 10%. Back in those days, the saying was, quote, one day's labor in 10. In other words, you would work one day in 10 for your master and not for yourself. Well, between 1764 and 1775, you know, leading up to the American Revolution, remember all the outrage over taxes and dumping tea in the harbor and all that stuff? Do you know what the tax rate was by England on Americans? 1%. That's one. Hold up one finger. 1%. That was the tax rate, which in part spurred the American Revolution. But does that kind of put that in context for you? Larry Summers, who was kind of a mucky muck in Obama's administration, Harvard graduate, of course, and vaunted economist, of course, he recently informed us, gee, this is why the Democrats are running around 70, 90%, quote, all Americans will have to pay a little more to support the kind of society they say they want, unquote. Really? I don't know who they is to you, Larry, but I can tell you that one member of they is not I. All right. And all this tax money to make you feel really good now that you finally reached the first 3 days of earnings actually for you in this whole year so far, you know, to make you feel good about the taxes you pay, let me give you some examples of how wisely our government spends money. And by the way, the list is like endless, 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 endless. Where is that sheet? I actually wrote this down because it was so mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. Oh, How about $998,798 to ship two, that's two, hold up two fingers, 19 cent, that's 19 one-hundredths of a dollar, 19 cents washers, you know, those round things that you put bolts through, from South Carolina to Texas. I'm not making this up, folks. $998,798 to ship two 19-cent washers, South Carolina, Texas. How about $350,000 to sponsor a NASCAR driver? Oh, well, that's certainly in the national interest. How about $200,000 to rid Californians of tattoos that they no longer wanted? How about $500,000 to paint the image of a salmon on an Alaska Airlines jetliner? Wow. Talk about crony capitalism. How about $3 billion spent to put sand on various beaches around the country so, you know, it could wash away in the ocean with the next 10 high tides? Oh, my. It's just, it makes your eyes cross. And I had some other examples here which literally are just as mind-boggling. But I won't bore you with them. You get the message, and you already knew it. The federal government spent $401 billion in February, but it only took in $167 billion. Gee, how would that work for your household? Our deficit will be over $1 trillion, as you know, this year. And trillion-dollar deficits go on and on and on, and it was all fueled by Obama's borrowing of $10 trillion in his 8 years, which, as we get further in here, we'll discuss. That was also intentional. The Trump tax cuts, by the way, also contributed to that, but they contributed to GDP, which increases tax revenues. I mean, I'm not sure it's quite a wash, but at least there's a contribution. Then we have Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. You'll love this. This is just terrific. They're the black holes of the federal budget. 78%. That's 78%. Of the federal budget by the year 2026, folks, that's 7 years from now, that's all. 78% of the federal budget will go into Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. That's before your Medicare for All from Bernie Sanders, another 188 million people on Medicare. Oh boy, I can't wait to see those numbers. Of course, Bernie won't share them with us. And the United States Treasury itself, that's the U.S. Treasury, this is not some think tank somewhere on either side of the ballgame, quote, projected taxes to fund Social Security and Medicare over the next 75 years will fall $46.7 trillion dollars short. Wow. I've talked on other shows, you can put it in the search bar on the website, they'll come right up. In fact, I was talking about this 5 years ago, about the unfunded liabilities of the United States. Those obligations, which don't show in the $22 trillion annual deficit, but which nonetheless exist and are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, which, by the way, is you and me. Oh, that's great. And you thought you were a millionaire. No, 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 no. You're underwater. Over the next 75 years, the GUS projects project America's debt at $211 trillion. $211 trillion. By the way, there's a professor by the name of Kotlikoff, Boston University, hardly a righty. He insists Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid aren't even properly or fully accounted for. So the numbers I just gave you, I might be light. How does that make you feel? That's good. Let me quote Kotlikoff. Quote, if you add up all the promises that have been made for spending obligations, including defense expenditures, and you subtract all the taxes that we expect to collect, the difference is $211 trillion. It's just math. That's the fiscal gap. That's our true indebtedness. He goes on, either a 53% immediate and permanent hike in all federal taxes or An immediate and permanent 33% cut in all federal expenditures is needed to eliminate this hole. By the way, you know when one of the Supreme Court Justice Holmes, I told you here at the beginning of the segment, he said taxes are what you pay for civilization. The taxes, that was 1904. The taxes that were paid by Americans in 1904, and this is all taxes, city, state, local, you name it, right? The federal income tax didn't come in until slightly later than 1904, was 3.5%. 3.5%. Well, look, I think you get kind of the message. There is the tax hole is a bottomless hole. The Democrats want to take that bottomless hole and create a black hole that goes all the way into outer space. We're going to talk more about this over the coming months, and I assume way more as the election approaches next year. But these were some fascinating stats, I thought, particularly relatively speaking. I mean, the American Revolution was fought in part based on a 1% tax. Wow. Wouldn't we all like to have that today? So, Trump said in the next segment, Trump said he was going to send illegal aliens to sanctuary cities, San Francisco and New York and Los Angeles. And, of course, all those bleeding heart liberals that have been so behind open borders and sanctuary cities and they all went nuts. All had a meltdown. No, they can't come here. No. In fact, Cher, who's like a huge anti-Trumper, and, you know, like alt-left. Of course, she has lots of money. I don't see her contributing it to any socialist causes. This is her tweet. I understand helping struggling immigrants, but my city, Los Angeles, isn't taking care of its own. What about the 50,000-plus citizens who live on the streets, who live below poverty lines, who are hungry? If my state can't take care of its own, many are vets. How can it take care of more? Well, wow. Welcome to the dark side there, Cher. The emperor is pleased to see you. You'll never guess the power of the dark side. And then Bill de Blasio. I mean, what a pathetic tweep. Bill de Blasio jumped up and down. It doesn't matter that New York is a sanctuary city. Remember, this is the guy who 6 months ago I had it on the show. He has proclaimed to the world that anybody who comes to New York, including illegal aliens, will get free health care. It's the same guy. But if the aliens that are coming across the border right now, where he says there is no crisis, shouldn't be a wall, if they are bused to his sanctuary city, quote, it's illegal. It is just plain illegal. We will meet him in court. We will beat him in court. End quote. You know, you got to love it. You got to love it. Then, here's some little tidbits. You remember we talked about the armies? You know, Khan's armies sweeping around the Christian knights 3,500 years ago and ransacking Europe. And we made the analogy of the hordes of American deplorables sweeping around the glittering lines of the so-called knights of the media and the Democratic Communist Party, and then turning around and attacking them, but via prosecutions from Barr and others. Well, let me tell you just some of the little interesting tidbits that I'm sure Bill Barr and his team that he's assembled are poring over, I hope, as I broadcast. I don't care that it's 2 in the morning. I hope as I broadcast. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Benghazi that's come out, which is, pathetic. So here's what's come out on Benghazi, and I told you, folks, I told you when Benghazi happened, it was never going to go away. And I think you're going to see it as part of the indictments that are going to be coming down. I certainly hope you do. For the United States not to stand behind its people as it did that night is truly, well, for a whole bunch of reasons, me personally, I can tell you, you never leave a man behind, and you always come to the aid of a fellow patriot and a fellow soldier. The reason Stevens, it's now been discovered, just, and I'm talking about very recently, was in Benghazi. And I, by the way, I promulgated a similar theory. I said Stevens was in Benghazi to sell arms and to try and cover the tracks of Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Hillary State Department, and who knows who else, in arms sales to Al-Qaeda. I said that 2.5 years ago. You can back listen to my shows in Benghazi. Just type it in the search bar. Well, now we find out, thanks to Judicial Watch and others, who are starting to get documents that, well, the State Department said never existed. And the FBI said they never saw, and, you know, the whole nine yards. The deep state kumbaya. Stevens was sent to Benghazi to retrieve U.S.-made Stinger missiles. This is like handheld, highly accurate, most sophisticated handheld anti-aircraft missile in the world. Stinger missiles that the State Department had supplied to Ansar al-Sharia in Libya. Oh, gee, and they forgot to tell Congress about it. Hillary Clinton, at that time the Secretary of State, brokered that deal in Libya through Ambassador Stevens and a private arms dealer by the name of Mark Turi. Unfortunately, the folks that got the missiles didn't do what they said they were going to do with them. Gee, what a surprise. And some of the missiles wound up in Afghanistan. And a U.S. Chinook helicopter was shot down by one, which fortunately, whatever Taliban moron fired it, had not armed it. It took the helicopter down, but they were able to land, and it didn't blow up, so they were able to recover the missile. And you know what they found? Do you remember we were talking about Qatar? This is where the Iranian negotiations began in Qatar with Valerie Jarrett and secret Iranian envoys. Qatar is the country that's been cast out, so to speak, of the Arab world by Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Jordan and a whole bunch of others because they're so radical and because they are the birthplace and the ATM for the Muslim Brotherhood, which we're going to be finishing up the show with here shortly. Well, it just so happens that that the missiles, the serial number off this missile that took down this Chinook but didn't blow up, was off the serial numbers of the Stinger missiles that the CIA kept in Qatar. Gee, it's amazing stuff, isn't it? And when that came out, our friend Barry and our friend Hillary, baby, went into panic mode. Oh my God. Congress is going to find out. It's going to be a big press thing, blah, 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 blah. And they sent Stevens to Benghazi to retrieve the rest of the Stinger missiles from Ansar al-Sharat. My personal opinion, although these documents do not show it, let me emphasize that, and I've said this for quite some time, is that Chris Stevens, one of two things, he was either meant to be captured and traded for the blind sheik, who the Muslim Brotherhood really wanted to get out of prison for the original 1996 attempted bombing of the World Trade Center, or he was meant to be killed because he knew too much about this whole Stinger missile CIA, Obama, Clinton, who knows who else, mess. And by the way, I think it's why help wasn't sent. Because they wanted to make sure that as few people survived as possible so they wouldn't talk. You know, Hillary's kind of known for that anyway. There have been two more murders in the last month. We'll talk about them on a future show. She's up to like 55 of her good friends gone in all sorts of mysterious ways, like shooting themselves twice in the back of the head. You know, suicide. This is why, in part, she wanted a private server. This is why she wiped that server. This is why she broke her cell phones. This is one of the reasons Barack Obama probably directed Loretta Lynch to make sure she got off the hook for all those felonies. You know, Lynch and Bill Clinton meeting on the tarmac, etc., etc., etc. And this is the reason, folks, the Taliban got some of these stingers. They knew what was going on. And it's my theory, and it's in this. You can read between the lines in this newly discovered document stash. The Taliban knew that Barry Baby had done this Stinger deal because they had some of the Stingers, and they blackmailed him. And the only thing that Barry could use to make it look like he wasn't getting blackmailed, that he wasn't doing something just off the cuff, by letting go of those five Taliban generals from Gitmo, was to get Bo Bergdahl, the traitor, back. So that's how all that came down. The Mueller probe, folks, and I've said this for a long time, and you'll see what I'm about to tie in here in a moment. The Mueller probe was more offense than... It was offensive defense. The former administration, virtually everybody in it at the top level, and by top level, you know, the top 50 to 100 people, I mean a lot of people, in all sorts of departments and agencies, were corrupt, treasonous snakes. Including, by the way, Dirty Cop Mueller, Dirty Cop Comey, you name it. And that is why the investigations were conjured and launched. That is why Mueller was a special counsel. That's why Mueller extended this investigate, plus, you know, the elections, etc., as long as he could, even though a year before he ended it this week or last week, he had already determined there was no collusion. He kept it alive for a year anyway. And of course, let's tie the threads together here. By influencing the 2018 midterms, he would have a chance at a Democratic House of Representatives, which would give him a chance at an impeachment, which he subtly, but not so much, exhorts them to do in the second 200 pages, which is a fairy tale rather than a legal report. You see how all this ties together? You know, the attempted deep state coup, the overthrow of our votes, never mind Donald Trump. I've told you for a long time, Donald Trump is our face. It is us they hate. You must understand that. It is basic, actually, to your survival and your security. And there I differ with many other conservative hosts who have a large voice. In fact, most of them larger than mine. Oh, they're after Trump and they hate Trump. No, no, no. They hate us. Trump is just the symbol of us. That's really key to understand. That's why they don't care about our security. They don't care about the paychecks. They don't care about the health care. They don't care about illegal aliens coming across the border to wreak havoc with our towns, our schools, and you name. They hate us. All right. Let me tell you another little tidbit that's been uncovered just in the last, give or take, a week. I told you last week, I quoted from Clapper, Liar Clapper, and he was on an MSNBC interview. Quote, if it weren't for President Obama, we might not have done this, the intelligence community assessment that we did that set off a whole sequence of events which are still unfolding today, notably Special Counsel Mueller's investigation. President Obama is responsible from that. Mr. Clapper, to remind you, was Obama's director of intelligence. Then they've uncovered a whole bunch of stuff in the State Department that they originally tried to get beginning in 2014. This is Judicial Watch. And they're just getting it. They just started getting this stuff in March, less than a month ago. And what's come to be clear is that Obama and his White House were disseminating all sorts of classified information to all these agencies, departments. I've talked about this, and he changed elections to a national security state. I mean, he did a bunch of things which allowed him to get a whole bunch of stuff out to a whole bunch of people that had never gotten similar stuff before and weren't supposed to. But it goes further. Clinton's State Department, or at that time Kerry's State Department, and Obama wanted to make sure that Capitol Hill, certain congressmen and senators had all this absolutely made up fake stuff that Hillary had paid for. Here's a one note from a gal by the name of Hillary Johnson, way high up in the State Department. She admits that the stuff is classified. She goes, flagging, I sent you a high side request for clearance of the draft transmittal letter to send documents to Senators Corker and Cardin. March 2017, Baltimore Sun. Maryland Senator Ben Cardin received classified information about Russia's involvement in elections when the Obama administration was attempting to disseminate that material widely across the government in order to aid in future investigations, according to a report Wednesday. Obama officials were concerned, according to the report in the New York Times, that the Trump administration would cover up intelligence once power changed hands. And I can go on and on. But this kind of a huge deal, folks. This brings to play a whole nother set of felonies. A whole nother set of felonies. By the way, and I'm going to talk about it next week, at the same time, right before this, and right after Benghazi, the United Nations, you know, I know quite a bit about Agenda 21. You can listen to my Coast to Coast interview. I have a whole section in my book, Land for Love and Money, landforloveandmoney.com, if you want to go take a look at it. And I was one of the first, not the first, but one of the first to raise the alarm about Agenda 21, which is one ugly document adopted by the United States, which is about global government's complete control. And by the way, has many of the elements that are in the bug-eyed babe from the Bronx's, Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal. It came right out of, not all of it, but a lot of it came out of Agenda 21. Well, since everybody kind of caught on to Agenda 21, and since Trump got elected and there was Brexit and everything was kind of put on hold and knocked back, the United Nations kind of tweaked the Agenda 21 plan. It's now called Agenda 2030. And part of that is a small arms trade treaty that was negotiated and virtually written by Obama and Hillary Clinton's State Department. We're going to talk about that next week. You'll find that really scary, really fascinating, and shall we say, you'll be angry. How's that? And as part of this, the UN, just this December, this is all part of Agenda 2030, signed this kind of no borders deal. It's actually the Globalization Pact, or the Refugee Pact. Different people call it different names, I think, to keep your eyes off the bouncing ball. But basically, it advocates open borders around the world, and the United Nations is directly involved, listen to me now, directly involved in the resettlement of refugees in the United States, sometimes under protection of UN police. UN, not US, UN. And funny enough, some of the most radical members of Congress have been elected from districts where there was the greatest refugee resettlement by the United Nations under their Refugee Pact. And they change the name of it every time. So whether today it's Globalization Pact, No Borders Pact, Refugee Pact, Immigration Pact, you name it, it's the same deal, part of 2030, the Agenda 2030 deal. We're going to be talking about that next week also. Very quick segment. Some interesting opportunities arising for Republicans, quote-unquote conservatives, to get even more control of the Senate, even though the map is not quite as favorable as it was in 2020. In New Mexico, think about this, New Mexico, the Democrat incumbent there, Tom Udall, he's retiring. So that Senate seat will be open. It could be flipped. In Alabama, Doug Jones, remember he beat Judge Roy Moore by like 1% or 2%. First Democrat elected in Alabama in, you know, decades and decades and decades. He is very vulnerable, and he's running about 20 points behind a generic Republican. Michigan, Democrat Senator Gary Peters is up for re-election. President Trump carried that state in 2016, although not by much. New Hampshire, Democrat Senator Jean Shaheen, God, she's a piece of work. She's up for re-election. This is one of the most competitive races in the country, folks. And she's in a dead heat right now against the Republican candidate. Dead heat. West Virginia, that's Joe Manchin. He's pondering running for governor in West Virginia in 2020. and that would open up his Senate seat for a Republican pickup. So some very interesting things kind of happening with the map for the 2020 senatorial elections. And I think we have all seen how important the Senate is, particularly in relation to judicial nominees, judicial appointments. I mean, it's critical. And getting the courts under control is critical, as we have seen by some of the rulings, if you want to call them that, by some of the Obama judges. Yes, sorry, Chief Justice John Roberts. There are Obama judges. There are Clinton judges. There are Reagan judges. And there are Trump judges and Bush judges. Very much so. Now, last segment. The Muslim Brotherhood. So, this is the second segment. Last week I talked about the foreign policy of Obama, which was designed very specifically to spread Islam, spread Islamist theories and tendencies, and to cede power to, increasing power to, the Muslim Brotherhood. Let me give you a little background. That's really what this part two is about. The Muslim Brotherhood, folks, in a nutshell, is manipulating, and they really got their claws into us during Obama's time, manipulating the American government. Their goal is totalitarian, genocidal, global Islamic State. That is the goal of the Muslim Brotherhood, and it's in their own papers. They are international, they are political, they are financial, they are terrorist, and they want to establish a global caliphate. You think ISIS was bad there in Iraq and Syria? No. ISIS was like, you know, that was like a fly compared to an eagle. They got tremendous influence in the United States, and particularly the United States government, when Barry was president. And all the violence that we currently have in the Middle East and across North Africa, and that was, if possible, peaked under Barry Obama, it's a direct consequence of the Muslim Brotherhood's effective control over American foreign policy in that region. Make no mistake about it. And they operate through a bunch of civic front groups. I've done shows on this before. I've talked about the mosques, the beehives of activity, all the front groups. And they have infiltrated American education by shoveling huge amounts of money to universities and think tanks, Georgetown University, the Brookings Institution. I can go on and on. Under Barack Obama's leadership in the White House and State Department, that's when the concept of Israel being the aggressor and Hamas and the Palestinians being oppressed, that's when it took hold. That is the ideology now espoused by Talib and Omar and the bug-eyed babe from the Bronx and all their ilk and Keith Ellison, who unfortunately is now State Attorney General of Minnesota but was a congressman and co-chair of the DNC, you know, that unholy alliance. In fact, type that in. I've done a whole show on that. The unholy alliance between the alt-left and Islamists. This was not, and I've said this a dozen times, this is key, this is not the result of incompetent, stupid, clueless on the part of Obama. It is the part of a calculated, brilliant, clever and cloaked plan that he set in motion, or that he brought to full realization. He was not misguided. Barack Obama, Valerie Jarrett, George Soros, his whole little crew, they were actually and consciously anti-American, anti-Semitic, anti-Christian, and anti-Western, pro-global, pro-Islamist, pro-alt-left. You know, when the freshman congressmen, who include anti-Semitic Omar, the gal who said about 9/11, you know, some people did something, talked about that a little bit last week, and Talib, who said, and I quote, "I feel more Palestinian when I'm in Congress than when I'm than American." That's a quote. Look it up. Google it. and on and on. Keith Ellison, you name it, that whole crew. But when he went to talk to them 3 weeks ago, he told Omar and Tlaib, remember, anti-Semitic tweets, just off the wall Islamists, that he was, and I quote, proud of you, unquote. Proud of you. Yes, you bet. The Muslim Brotherhood was founded in 1928. It was also known as the Society of Muslim Brothers, and I can't pronounce this too well, but I'll do my best, or Al-Ikhwan al-Muslimun in Arabic. When it was created in the 1920s, you'll find this fascinating, another indication of the unholy alliance between the alt-left and Islamists. The Brotherhood was a contemporary of the Nazi Party in Germany. Okay? The Nazi Party, remember, National Socialist Democratic Party, alt-left party headed by Adolf Hitler, not right, as all these morons would have you believe. I mean, you know, please, you must know some history. Please, just a tad. Do us a favor. Do yourself a favor. Do the country a favor. The head honcho back then was a guy by the name of Amin al-Husseini. Many people believe that he is the one who gave the idea for the final solution, i.e. the extinction or the termination, the genocide of the Jews, to Hitler. Many people believe that. He visited Berlin in 1941, and it was shortly after that, after he left, that Hitler began that systematic extermination of Jews and other minorities. Maybe a coincidence? Nobody seems to think so. The Holocaust back then and the genocide in the Middle East right now, particularly as it relates to Christians and certain sects of Muslims, more moderate sects of Muslims, is kind of a repeat, you know, without the gas chambers and the rail cars and the concentration camps, although you can consider ISIS, you could consider ISIS occupation a concentration camp, but it's a repeat of the Holocaust, but in this case directed at Christians and moderate Muslims. I mean, these things hold true through the history of the Muslim Brotherhood. When the Cold War began, Russia and the United States, the Muslim Brotherhood, working with former Nazis and the American CIA, they were all working together, it became an ally, supposedly. I don't believe that they meant it, but, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, against the Soviet Union, you know, back there in the Cold War. American aid to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and the Muslim uprising against the Russians in, oh yes, Afghanistan. Huh? Amazing how things come full circle. And other places. In the current time, kind of after World War II, the Muslim Brotherhood kind of went international. It wasn't in just a few countries here and there. And it began to aggressively promote civilizational and, where necessary, violent jihad. It got involved in financial interests, business interests. It had agents, supporters, apologists in all the Western governments, and a support network of quote-unquote civic networks. And all of them serve as cover. They serve as their face. They pretend to be benign, you know, like CARE and the Islamic Society of North America, ISNA, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, MPAC, and the Muslim Students Association, MSA. I've talked about all these in previous shows. The United Arab Emirates, these are Arabs, folks, Muslims, have designated the Muslim Brotherhood front groups who operate in the United States as terrorist entities. They also declared that the Council on Islamic Relations, CARE, you know, the guys you see whining about the Muslim oppression in the United States, the group that Omar was addressing when she said some people did something and raising money for. Those people. The UAE, the United Arab Emirates, has termed them a terrorist organization. So, by the way, has Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and a host of other Arab countries, but not the United States. Oh, no. We still have the deep state that Obama appointed protecting these people as they burrow deeper and deeper and deeper into the fabric of our society, our values, and our government. Quite scary and quite brilliant, unfortunately. The Muslim Brotherhood, folks, is the mothership for Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Hamas, the Taliban, and Boko Haram, just to name a few. It is the mothership for all these outfits. I mean, avowed terrorist outfits. And it is evil beyond recognition, and it is now speculated that Barry Obama, we know he was affiliated with them. We know he supported them. We know he backed them taking over power in Egypt and tried to get them to take over power in other places. Many speculate that he's actually a Muslim brother, a member of the Brotherhood. I guess, I don't know if we'll ever know or not. I suppose we will, in one way, shape, or form. Maybe Mr. Barr in his investigation. You know, the domestic Muslim Brotherhood here in the United States, they actually help because of what Obama did in getting them in certain key government positions. They dictate our counterterrorism policies. It is their idea. Do you remember when Obama, this was about 3 years ago, Obama stood up at the National Prayer Breakfast and everybody was shocked when he said, you know, you don't have to worry about the Muslims. It's not their fault. It's all the fault of the Christian crusade 1,200 years ago. I mean, everybody went, what? Where did that come from? Well, if you look at the Muslim Brotherhood papers, you can tell exactly where that shocking statement by an American president came from, of a Judeo-Christian country, right? Qatar is like the home base for the Brotherhood. It is the money laundering center for all their activities, all these front groups, all their supportive terrorist organizations, you name it, which is why Qatar has been ostracized, I mean cut off from the rest of the Arab world. It is why Qatar acts as the intermediary, quote-unquote, between Iran and the United States. It's why Qatar is where the first meetings of the Iranian deal with Valerie Jarrett and Iranian ministers that would have resulted in Iran getting a nuclear bomb and a nuclear missile, nuclear warhead. 6 years from now, 10 years from when that deal was done, with no ramifications included. I mean, it was in the agreement. Never to mind $150 billion of our money and $1.7 billion in cash and, you know, all the other things. I've talked about it, and I think you know kind of the facts, shall we say. The Muslim Brotherhood was also instrumental in writing Common Core. Ladies, I mean, I sure hope that most of you probably don't, but I hope many of you homeschool, because our public education system has been absolutely corrupted. 95% of it by alt-left and Islamists working tandemly. Common Core was actually partially written by the Muslim Brotherhood during Obama's tenure in the White House. They've also been involved in Obama's positions on illegal immigration amnesty, which we're fighting today. The hostility of Obama against police officers. In one of the upcoming segments, I'm going to name some of the top Muslim Brotherhood operatives that Obama appointed to incredible. I mean, you will gasp when you hear what positions he appointed them to in the White House and various agencies of the United States government. And Obama's acts and lack of acts were bad enough, but the influence that was exerted on him in not taking acts and taking acts by George Soros and Valerie Jarrett is maybe even more scary, because George Soros, He's a scary, scary dude. Scary dude. By the way, this has been sourced from things called the Betrayal Papers and a whole bunch of other articles that I've been putting together for a while. Dr. Ashraf Ramallah, Shea King, Benjamin Smith, Brent Parrish, Hannah Sazenz, Gary Kubiak, Dick Manasseri, a bunch of folks. I just want to give them a little credit because they did a yeoman's job in pulling much of this information together. So that is part two of Civilizational Jihad, the Takeover of America. And parts 3, 4, and 5, oh, shiver your timbers, folks. Shiver your timbers, particularly the one where I'm going to get into who really is Barack Hussein Obama. And this will be the first show that I've put together, and I've had many shows on this aspect of his life and his book, Dreams from My Father, and his father, and all sorts of things. This will be the first show that puts it all together and ties it into the Muslim Brotherhood, and then from there into the policies that we're fighting today. So, once again, I wish you absolutely a terrific holiday, whether it's Easter, Passover, whatever have you, tomorrow and this weekend. And we will talk to you next week. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.